also declined, with Arab donations falling to less than 3% of UNRWA's budget in 2022. This decline in Arab funding appears to be a consequence of several Arab regimes. The United Arab Emirates, Morocco, Bahrain, and Sudan signing the so-called Abraham Accords in 2020 and thus establishing diplomatic relations with the fake regime of Israel. In 2018, the United Arab Emirates contributed nearly $54 million helping to allay UNRWA's budget deficit after Washington cut off funding. The following year, its contributions decreased to $51.8 million. However, the UAE only donated $1 million in 2020, the year the accords with the Zionist regime was signed. Last year, it did not offer any financial support. It also reflects how, for decades, the Zionist regime and its supporters in the United States have targeted UNRWA. Former Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu previously called for UNRWA to be dismantled because it perpetuates the Palestinian refugee problem. The Trump administration adopted similar rhetoric and sought to change the definition of a Palestinian refugee. At the beginning of 2021 to 2022 academic school year, the European Parliament blocked 20 million euros in aid to UNRWA, demanding changes to be made to textbooks used in UNRWA schools for assistance to resume. UNRWA claims that the partnerships referenced by Lazzarini are neither new nor will they replace the agency. In a June 5th email interview, Hoda Samra, UNRWA's senior media and communications advisor in Lebanon field office, said that partnerships were a reference to partnerships between UNRWA and other UN agencies, funds, and programs. The partnerships have been a part of operations since UNRWA was first established, she said, adding that UNRWA will engage with key stakeholders, including UN agencies, hosts, and donors during the coming months to discuss the partnership's option, and it expects to reach a collective agreement on the way forward within 2022. Samra said the idea of expanding partnerships is still at an early stage, with initial consultations taking place between the UNRWA Commissioner General and his senior counterparts within the UN system. Yet outside observers are concerned that UNRWA's weak financial state and lack of political support will only worsen in time. Palestinian author and historian Salman Abu Setah told the author by email at the beginning of June that the United States and the Zionist regime are trying to eliminate UNRWA altogether by transferring its activities to other agencies. This means that Palestinians will not have a right of return, and they can only seek food and shelter elsewhere away from their homeland, he added. UNRWA Samra dismissed the notion that the agency's services will be taken over and outsourced. Any service delivery to Palestine refugees that falls under the UNRWA mandate is also under its responsibility, she said. Samra emphasized that support from UN partners will be on behalf of UNRWA and not in replacement of it.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we saw that more than 50 countries have depleted uranium weapons. These weapons have been used extensively by U.S. and NATO forces during the past three decades, namely in Iraq and the Balkans. The consequences for both military personnel and civilians have proven to be tragic. Yet despite the evidence, the military industry and nuclear authorities continue to downplay the dangers. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the program.
Our soldiers on peace missions in the Balkans are said to have been contaminated due to the presence of depleted uranium in the munitions.
My friends, we have with us Sergeant Major Antonacci. Unfortunately, you're ill. Could you tell us how this came about?
I left on August the 31st, 1998, for a six-month mission. I got the go-ahead after medical checks. During my stay in Sarajevo, I suffered several faint and dizzy spells. And a few months after I came back, these were attributed to lymphoma.
Cancer?
In Florence, I meet General Fabio Mini. In 2002, he takes command of the NATO mission in Kosovo. He's immediately concerned by the risks involved with depleted uranium, following NATO strikes in the area in 1999.
My chain of command, formed by an American admiral in Naples and the supreme Allied commander in Brussels, stood by the official directives and reports, including those drawn up by scientists in the U.S. I was therefore frequently confronted with this type of response. It's true, Fabio. You're right to be worried, but we have reports which say that there's no problem. And from a military point of view, we can't bypass them to do things that go beyond what is asked of us, and which could even prevent us from accomplishing our mission. So it was recommended that we reiterate and support among the civil population the fact that it wasn't a grave danger, that it was quite normal, and to say to the military, especially the engineer corps, treat the depleted uranium munitions like any other type of munitions. But a grenade is not the same thing as a depleted uranium projectile. I'll tell you something. In 2007, I was treated for a tumor in my colon. I never wondered if it was because of the year I spent in Kosovo. But I'll always have doubts. I still have a doubt today that it was perhaps due to that.
Politicians in Rome are mobilized, as is the government. For the first time, without waiting for definitive scientific confirmation, a law recognizes the danger of depleted uranium. When Arturo Parisi is appointed Minister of Defense in 2006, the case is one of his first preoccupations.
Our concern is that the suffering, the pain, the injuries, deaths, and damage should never go beyond, by even a millimeter, what has been foreseen in some way. The problem with depleted uranium, and this was what worried us, is that not only does it produce negative effects, as in the military sector almost everything produces negative effects, but also that it produces uncontrollable effects, which go beyond the present. That's the problem with depleted uranium. So from this point of view, something that might appear not too costly could, on the contrary, with time, become very costly.
Here we have a depleted uranium shell. Its radioactivity level is 40% less than what we can find here in this room.
The Atlantic Alliance is slow to acknowledge the use of depleted uranium weapons in the Balkans. In 2001, an official report estimates the quantities used at more than 3 tons in Bosnia and 10 tons in Kosovo. But NATO command refuses to confirm any link whatsoever between its airstrikes and any contamination. When I contacted the Allied Forces Communications Agency in Brussels, nobody was willing to answer my questions. In France, Alain Acariès is an inconsolable father. His son died in 1997 from lymph gland cancer. Ludovic was a soldier driving a truck in Bosnia, a truck that was contaminated, claims Alan Akaries, by depleted uranium dust since the Gulf War. He had his suspicions confirmed by an independent laboratory.
Mr. Akaries provided them with several samples of his son's cancerous lymph glands taken in a French hospital after his death. A powerful electronic microscope and a new technique perfected by Professor Gatti revealed the interior of the tissue.
We can clearly see the tiny particles, nanoparticles. They're not degradable nor compatible. They're not compatible with life.
Even more surprising is the chemical composition of these nanoparticles.
There is silver, chlorine, gold, magnesium, and silicon, which form a very strange material that doesn't exist in nature.
You've been working on this case for 11 years, and you've taken legal action. What's the situation today?
Despite what was revealed by the examination, the link with depleted uranium has been denied.
But why are you doing all this?
I want the truth to be acknowledged. I want people to accept that my son was contaminated through the fault of the army, which didn't decontaminate the trucks in the Gulf. Something has to be done. We can't just let it slide. It's been the biggest tragedy in my life.
An association, Avigolf, of which Alan Akaries is a member, has been formed to inform potential depleted uranium victims, most of whom are soldiers, and to support them in their legal battles for justice. I met the magistrate in charge of the affairs filed with the county court in Paris. But the judge, Bertala Geoffroy, is naturally subject to rules of confidentiality. Despite the slow legal progress, Alan Akaries is still hopeful of winning the case he has lodged. Against him, the military institution remains rooted in its own convictions.
We're not unfamiliar with the debate, and we're taking it into account. But quite simply, we can observe that until now, no study, and God knows many studies have been carried out through the United Nations Environmental Programme, the World Health Organization, or by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and no study has highlighted or demonstrated any long-term harmful consequences on health or on the environment.
Are there any operational theatres where France has intervened recently where these depleted uranium weapons have been used?
No, these weapons haven't been used by France in any operational theatres. I would remind you that depleted uranium munitions are conventional weapons and recognized as such by every international convention. They're not nuclear weapons, which the word uranium could suggest.
France's position is in contradiction with efforts undertaken by the European Parliament. For years, European deputies have been calling for a moratorium on the manufacture and use of these weapons, with MEPs voting such resolutions almost unanimously. Monica Frassoni is co-president of the European Green Party.
The ongoing story began with strange events during the Gulf War, then continued and intensified with the war in Yugoslavia, and it became an almost traditional theme for the European Parliament. One important element, in my view, is that France and the UK have always refused to enforce bans and to support the moratorium on depleted uranium. Very often, we can see the extreme reticence of governments and armies, even of political forces, to raise the subject in public.
The urgent need for more concerted political action against depleted uranium is only more apparent when a new war breaks out, exposing new risks. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq. In 2003, the United States attacked Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein, who continues to taunt the U.S. despite 12 years of rigorous sanctions. At the time, I'm in Baghdad, witnessing the repeated air attacks targeting the presidential palaces with depleted uranium projectiles. It's a short-lived war. In just 3 weeks, the Americans removed the dictator. Jim McDermott is not a typical American congressman. He's one of the few who have seen war close up. As an officer, he served in Vietnam, and as a psychiatrist, he has treated some of those who survived.
When I was dealing,
Bush lied, because I went over to Iraq and what became Baghdad Jim, not by intention, but because I was there, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, I think he's going to mislead us to get us into war. And so then we did it to all the rest of the country. I mean, and Fallujah was the Basra of 91. Fallujah was where we used absolutely awesome power to destroy that city.
In 2004, the Americans are confronted with massive insurrection. The epicenter is Fallujah. To stem the revolt, the city is bombarded. A deluge of fire rains down with white phosphorus and depleted uranium munitions. Today, peace has been restored to the city of mosques, and life has returned under the watchful eye of the Iraqi army. At the new hospital, Dr. Samira Alan shows me the tragedy she has to face every day.
They born prematurely, and before they complete their pregnancy, just less than 8 months. And one of them born with cleft lip and palate.
These babies will have surgery, right?
Of course, if he
survives.
If he survives, yes.
Yeah.
Since 2006, we start to notice that there is an abnormal increase in the incidence of congenital anomalies among the birth in our hospital. According to the cases we have, we register, the incidence about 14.7 per thousand live birth.
What would be a normal rate of deficiency?
It should not exceed 1 or 2 per thousand. We examined 25 families from Fallujah. Those families have babies born with birth defects. We took hair sample from the kids and from the parents, and we sent these samples to an independent lab in Germany, and we found high concentration of uranium, mercury, bismuth, and other trace elements that is not usually used by human being and not naturally present in the soil or in the plants.
In Baghdad, the authorities have to take their religious leaders' opinions into account. Their voices carry weight, and their criticism is widely heard. Jawad al-Halisi is the heir to a very influential dynasty, and he protests strongly against what he sees as an attack on his people's genetic integrity.
These deformed children are the result of the use of depleted uranium. They're deformed fetuses. An international effort is required to clean up. In the same way, they brought together 30 countries and their armies under the pretext of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They should work together on a cleansing project, like with the Marshall Plan in Germany, because the sanitary situation in Iraq is catastrophic.
Unlike after the Gulf War of 1991, the U.S. Defense Department has never published figures concerning the use of depleted uranium during the war in Iraq in 2003. Unofficial estimates speak of over 2,000 tons. Since the beginning of my investigation, I've been trying to obtain a reaction from the Pentagon. After weeks of exchanging emails, a spokesman finally responds. Dear sir, we won't be able to accommodate your on-camera interview request. The scientific community have investigated the radiological safety and environmental impacts of depleted uranium for several decades. The Agency for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that it is aware of no cancers or cases of leukemia among workers or other populations that can be attributed to exposure to natural or depleted uranium. In Washington, Time magazine called Thomas Pickering the five-star general of the diplomatic corps. He was actively involved in the international mobilization against Saddam Hussein in 2001, but he openly opposed the war in 2003.
Iraqis who say, look, we came in and created a mess and we didn't resolve it all, in my view, have some justification for their position. I leave it to wise men, lawyers, and judges to tell you whether the answer to the Iraqi is we still owe them more. But if I were an Iraqi, I suppose they would say, yeah, you've got to create a perfect paradise here.
I can understand from an armament standpoint and from a strategic planning standpoint why you'd want to have the hardest and the best weapons that could just demolish anything. They're unwilling to look at the aftermath of it and what the Geneva Convention and other things say about, you know, what you leave on the ground afterward. The military is not very well known for its ability to clean up after itself.
The official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great, because it's really effective, and it's recyclable, too. I think in that situation, there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium-producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
الشباب هذا
time.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap when it gets there? When they bring it there, then they put it in the ground. What do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately, you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create. Then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by near the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
And that's it for this week's episode. And don't forget to share your thoughts and comments with us. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Republicans appear poised to take a congressional district that the party has not held in more than 30 years, as an opinion poll shows the GOP candidate leading six potential Democratic competitors. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Derek Roche. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled, Republicans Set to Flip Deep Blue Seat Held by Democrats for Over 30 Years. Republicans appear poised to take a congressional district that the party has not held in more than 30 years, as an opinion poll shows the GOP candidate leading six potential Democratic competitors. A Suffolk University Boston Globe opinion poll shows Republican Alan Fung ahead of the six Democrats who are seeking their party's nomination in Rhode Island's second congressional district. The second district has been represented by a Democrat in the House of Representatives since 1991. And, if the opinion poll is accurate, it could indicate trouble for Democrats far beyond Rhode Island. If Republicans can flip a seat that has been blue for three decades, President Joe Biden's party could be facing major losses in the midterm elections as he continues to struggle with a low approval rating. Alan Fung, a former mayor of Cranston and two-time gubernatorial nominee, led five of the six Democratic candidates by around 10 percentage points, but this lead was narrower with Seth Magaziner, who is considered the Democratic front-runner. Alan Fung led Seth Magaziner by 45% to 39% in the Suffolk University poll, a margin of just 6 percentage points. A further 17% of voters were undecided between Magaziner and Fung in what could be a crucial finding. Magaziner is currently Rhode Island General Treasurer and was a candidate for the 2022 gubernatorial nomination before withdrawing from that race. The opinion poll was conducted from 19th to 22nd of June among 432 likely midterm election voters in Rhode Island's 2nd Congressional District and had a margin of error of plus or minus 4.8%. Democrats have held the seat for the Rhode Island 2nd Congressional District since 1991, and the incumbent, Representative Jim Langevin, has represented the district since 2001. He's retiring at the end of this term, and he's not seeking re-election. The last Republican to win election in the 2nd Congressional District was former Representative Claudine Schneider, who served in Congress from 1981 to 1991, but declined to seek re-election in 1990 and mounted an ultimately unsuccessful U.S. Senate bid. The Suffolk University Boston Globe opinion poll found that among 172 likely Democratic primary voters in the 2nd District, Magaziner enjoyed 30.2% support, far surpassing the other candidates who failed to score 10% each. However, 43% of respondents were undecided. Alan Fung enjoyed a substantial lead among the 102 likely Republican primary voters surveyed, with 66.67% backing him against rival candidate Robert Lancia, who had 14.7% support, while 13.7% were undecided. The primaries are not due to take place until 13th of September. The possibility of a Republican in Rhode Island winning a congressional seat could have national implications in similar districts, said Davy Paleologos, director of the Suffolk University Political Research Center, in a statement issued with the opinion poll on Monday. Democrats may have cause for concern after Republican Myra Flores flipped a congressional seat in Texas's 34th district in a special election. The district was historically Democratic. Republicans are hoping to retake the House in November, which would effectively allow them to stymie President Joe Biden's agenda. President Biden's involvement could actually hinder the eventual Democratic nominee, who must thread the needle of connecting with undecided voters who believe the Rhode Island economy is awful, while supporting President Biden's agenda, which is seen as detrimental to that very economy, Paleologos said. The opinion poll found that 82% of respondents said the economic situation in Rhode Island was either fair or poor, and just 16% rated it as good or excellent. The country continues to suffer rising prices, and the annualized rate of inflation was 8.6% in May, while gasoline prices have reached new record highs in recent weeks.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. I said that Imam was a fighter. This means that Imam was continuously present in the arena of rising for the cause of God. Imam was truly vigilant about rising for the cause of God. The establishment of the truth and justice was naturally Imam's goal. Well, how can this goal be realized? The establishment of the truth and justice was Imam's goal. But is it possible to establish the truth under the hideous roof of the Pahlavi regime and every other dependent regime? Naturally, no. So the next goal is to bring down this roof. Therefore, Imam tried to remove the hideous roof of the Pahlavi regime for the nation and lay the groundwork for their movement, their uprising, and their progress. Let us split open the roof of the sky and lay out a new design. This is a poem by Hafiz, the Persian poet. This included both a rejection and an establishment.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
First, the rejection of the Taghuti regime, and then the establishment of a desirable political system which could move the people forward. This was Imam's movement in the area of rejection and establishment. There were a number of outstanding points in the movement of Imam. First of all, there was no fear in him. He did not use to fear and flatter. He was outspoken and had an eloquent tongue. This dates back to the revolutionary era in Qom and Najaf. He would speak to the people and would constantly explain and guide. His tongue was truly a decisive dhulfiqar with which he would move things forward. He was outspoken. He trusted the people. One of the most important qualities of Imam was his trust in the people from the first day. There were people who wanted to fight, but who said that the people would not follow them? However, Imam believed from the first day that if we entered the arena, the people would follow.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Nearly half of U.S. Republicans have said mass shooting incidents should be accepted as part of a free society. Following strict messaging guidelines, Republican politicians repeatedly claim mental health and security issues are to blame for mass shooting incidents in the U.S., not access to guns. We now present you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Poll Finds Nearly Half of Republicans Think U.S. Has to Live with Mass Shootings. According to an opinion poll released in the aftermath of the Texas elementary school murders, and as politicians in Washington negotiate for gun reform, nearly half of Republican voters think the U.S. just has to live with mass shooting incidents. The CBS and YouGov opinion poll returned familiar results, including 62% support for a nationwide ban on semi-automatic rifles, the kind of gun used in Uvalde, Texas. 19 young children and 2 adults were killed at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas on 24th of May by an 18-year-old teenager who bought his weapon legally. But clear national support for a ban on such rifles or changes to purchasing ages and background checks is not mirrored in Congress. Most Republican politicians, supported financially by the powerful gun lobby, remain opposed to gun reform. In an effort fueled by horror at events in Uvalde, Texas, senators led by Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, elected after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting incident, which killed 26 in 2012, and John Cornyn, a Texas Republican, have expressed optimism that some changes may be possible. On Monday, 6th of June, Chris Murphy told NBC News, "Sometimes when we go away for a week, sensitive negotiations like this fall apart. This week, the opposite is happening, because my colleagues went home and heard the same thing I did. Parents are frightened to death." He said, "They're frightened to death for their kids, and they're frightened to death that government isn't going to be able to respond. The most fundamental concern the parents have, the safety of their children. I think senators are coming back to town today with a newfound resolve to get something done." Reporting on the Senate talks has largely focused on red flag laws designed to stop gun purchases by people deemed a potential danger to others or to themselves. In the CBS YouGov opinion poll, support for such laws ran at 72%. Senator Chris Murphy was asked, "Is this about incentivizing states to pass their own red flag laws or a federal one?" He said, "I actually don't think it will be a good idea to have a federal red flag law. I think it will be very inaccessible for local law enforcement to have to go to the federal court system. So I support the state laws. I think they need some guidance and some funding in order to implement these laws and make sure that everybody knows how to access them. A Senate reform package could also contain efforts to close loopholes in background checks." In the CBS YouGov opinion poll, support for federal background checks on all gun purchases ran at 81%. President Biden has called for an assault weapons ban, or at least raising the minimum age for purchases of guns. In the new opinion poll, 77% said the minimum age for buying an assault rifle should be higher than 18. 32% said it should be 21, and 45% said it should be over 25. Senator Chris Murphy said, "I think there's certainly Republican support for raising the age. I don't know whether there are 60 votes yet, and right now, my entire focus is on what can get 60 votes." But the new opinion poll's most telling evidence came when respondents were asked if mass shooting incidents were unfortunately something we have to accept as part of a free society, or something we can prevent and stop if we really tried. Among Democrats, 85% said mass shooting incidents could be stopped if U.S. politicians would only try. Among independent voters, the figure was 73%. Overall, it was 72%. But 44% of Republicans said mass shooting incidents should be accepted as part of a free society. Following strict messaging guidelines, Republican politicians repeatedly claimed mental health and security issues are to blame for mass shooting incidents and not access to guns. Those who took part in the opinion poll were also asked, regardless of how you feel about the issue, how likely do you think it is that Congress will pass any laws in the next few months that will make significant changes to gun policy? Only 7% thought it was very likely that Congress would act, while a combined 69% thought it was not very likely or not at all likely. Some state governments have passed the so-called reforms. In New York City, on Monday, 6th of June, the state governor, Kathy Hochul, signed a package of laws including licensing measures for assault rifles and a minimum purchase age of 21, expanded red flag provisions, and a ban on sales of body armor. Kathy Hochul told reporters, "It just keeps happening. Shots ring out, flags come down, and nothing ever changes, except here in New York." However, the state is home to another politician whose fate starkly shows what can happen to Republicans who express openness to gun reform. On Friday, 3rd of June, the New York Congressman Chris Jacobs abandoned his bid for re-election after stoking fury by expressing support for a federal assault weapons ban. Congressman Chris Jacobs represents a suburb of Buffalo, New York, the city in which 10 people were shot dead at a supermarket on 14th of May in what authorities say was a racially motivated attack. Mass shooting incidents, widely defined as shootings in which 4 people, excluding the gunman, are held or killed, have continued since the Buffalo incident and the elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Recently, at a hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a gunman killed 2 doctors, a receptionist, and a patient. According to the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive, the following weekend saw mass shooting incidents in Philadelphia, Chattanooga, South Carolina, Arizona, Texas, Georgia, New York, and Michigan. 15 people were killed and more than 60 others were wounded. The archive says there have been 246 mass shooting incidents in the United States in 2022, considerably more than one a day. On Sunday, 5th of June, Senator Chris Murphy claimed, "The possibility of success is better than ever before. But I think the consequences of failure for our entire democracy are more significant than ever." According to a new opinion poll, most Americans believe the new legislation aimed at reducing gun violence should be prioritized over protecting gun rights. The ABC Ipsos opinion poll, which comes in the wake of a deadly string of mass shooting incidents in the U.S., said 7 out of 10 people in the country prioritize laws reducing gun violence over gun rights. The opinion poll showed only 21%, or less than one-third of those interviewed, believed that gun rights should be a higher priority than reducing gun violence in the country. Most Democrats said lawmakers should prioritize laws focused on reducing gun violence, while about half of the Republican respondents said protecting the rights of gun owners is a higher priority. The opinion poll was conducted from 3rd to 4th of June as the country mourned those killed in multiple mass shooting incidents, including 10 people at a grocery store in New York, 21 at an elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. The political debate over gun control has been one of the most divisive issues in U.S. society for decades. The issue of gun control has culminated in a multi-million dollar lobbying campaign, congressional standoffs, and mass demonstrations for those for and against gun laws. The root of the debate is a single sentence in the U.S. Constitution, where the Second Amendment says, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." A dispute on the interpretation of the Second Amendment separates the Democrats, who believe in stricter gun control laws, from the Republicans, who see any such legislation as an infringement of their gun rights.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The town of Olomouckia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as the town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. While I'm filming the boom of outgoing artillery, two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon, so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 meters or 100 meters around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit these artillery pieces rather than just aiming at civilians.
Incredibly, in this desolate place, some civilians still live here, although most cower inside.
So what is it like to live here?
It's bad. My nerves are shredded and it's always tense. What kind of a state is Ukraine that kills its own people, sending brother against brother? We are hoping soon for victory.
In the adjacent city of Golovka, I meet the well-known mayor, Ivan Prokhodko. He uses a Ukrainian flag as the doormat to his office.
This flag lying over there symbolizes the criminal state of Ukraine, not its people. The flag is my personal trophy as well. I took it at the front line. I was born in Donetsk and I loved Ukraine. But those who took power in 2014 in the coup trampled over democracy, and they do not care about the citizens of the East.
Who do you blame for the breakup of Ukraine?
The answer is obvious. NATO countries are to blame, in particular the United States. They needed Ukraine as a hotbed of tension at the border with Russia. You see, I'm for democracy. In 2014, they should have asked what people wanted. But nobody was interested in people's opinion. That's why we have got what we have now. We have a terrible war, dead Ukrainians, dead Russians. It's really horrible. And those who draw benefit from it are sitting across the ocean.
While Russia calls this war a special military operation, Ukraine calls it an invasion. But here in Donbass, the pro-Russian civilians call it a liberation operation. With the Russian army making gains not far to the north of these desperate streets, the 8 years of war in this town might finally be set to end. Jenny Melikolovka.